everyone. It's that time of the week again, and I'm Jeff Snyder, founder and CEO of The Morning Pulse, and I'm joined by George Grombacher, who is the host of the Money Savage podcast. Welcome to the Weekly Pulse Sunday. George, how was your trip, bud?
Here we go, Jeff. I'm feeling 100%, fully recovered from not enough sleep and maybe one or two too many beers, but it's all good.
Okay. Well, and you didn't gamble?
Huh?
Gamble. Okay. We'll leave that there. Well, I'm excited. Maybe we can hear a little bit more about your trip. Whatever you can disclose.
Sure.
At some point during the show. But we've got a lot to cover this week, George. I mean, we've got great guests, great contributors. We're going to hear from Kevin Walsh from Groom Law. Then turn things over to our market experts, Kevin Kelly. Got his name right. Hopefully, I'll get it right during the segment. Hmm. And Oliver Rennick from TD Ameritrade. We'll bring on our friend Ali Melito, and then we've got a great interview. One of our peers in the space, James Venaruso from Callan, is going to be joining us. So I think it's going to be wonderful, and I know I'm excited. How about you, George?
Yeah, once again, another great lineup to help us make sense of this crazy, crazy world. So
it is a crazy world, and without further ado, let's bring on our friend, our Legal Eagle. I don't know if you remember that movie, George. Maybe it's a little way back, but that was a great movie. Our Legal Eagle and the guy who knows everything, well, almost everything about what's going on the Hill, legislatively and regulatorily, our friend Kevin Walsh from Groom Law. Kevin, how are you, bud?
Good morning, Jeff and George. I'm doing pretty well. I'm happy to be on, and with a lull in the fiduciary rule litigation and with RESA not being included in the omnibus, I was looking for really what's gone on and what's been exciting in this last week. And the Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards released a new standard, which really weighs into it's them getting involved again in the question of what the right standard of advice is for retirement investors. So this seemed like a great week to kind of springboard into kind of the ongoing question of what's the standard of care for retirement investors? What should it be? So before I dive into that, the new standard, I mean, you've got to keep in the back of your mind, there's a handful of factors. So access to advice, the quality of advice, the cost of the advice, and how consumers pay for the advice. And these are all things that different regulators, the Department of Labor, the CFP Board, and others have been really kind of looking at, and there's trade-offs. So historically, there's been two standards, suitability and fiduciary. When I think of suitability, I think suitability is when I walk into a shop and I ask someone in the shop to help me figure out what to get. So they're gonna figure out what in the store is right for me, but they might not tell me that there's another shop down the street that I could get something else at. Then I think of fiduciary as when I walk into a shop, they're likely to, I'm not going to be interacting with a salesperson at the shop. I'm going to need to bring my own personal shopper with me. So these are really the two standards we've had historically, where it's either I'm walking in and talking to a salesperson, or I'm walking in with my own personal shopper. And here, kind of with the DOL rule and with the CFP board, we've been moving into some kind of intermediate standards, which really kind of get at kind of the interesting time we are in the retirement space. So the CFP board, it's really interesting because they're one of the groups that supported the Department of Labor's efforts with the fiduciary rule. And they've introduced language, which is going to go into effect next year for people who want the CFP certification. And their standard, it's a best interest standard like DOL's. And it says that the professional must act without regard to the financial or other interests of the CFP professional, the CFP professional's firm, or any individual or entity other than the client. And what's interesting there is they've included this without regard to language, which was one of the big sticking points of the fiduciary rule fight, where, you know, if I'm trying to get someone to hire me, how can I try to get them to hire me really without any regard to my own interests? There's got to be some regard, otherwise I wouldn't be trying to get hired.
Right.
The CFP board then adds on something at the end, which says, which means that a CFP professional acting under a conflict of interest continues to have a duty to act in the best interest of the client and place the client's interest above the CFP professionals. So it hints that there's some ambiguity now as to whether the CFP board is going for the DOL's without regard standard or to a standard where it's put the interests of the client first. And just in this space, it's really interesting to watch because the states are active, and it appears that we've now have really at least four standards. We have the fiduciary standard. We have DOL's best interest standard, which some states are considering. We have CFP board's best interest standard, which looks a lot like the National Association of Insurance Commissioners model rule. And then we have suitability. And just as we watch the states, as we watch this develop, both people on the distribution side, so if you're a broker, if you're a registered investment advisor, you're going to want to pay attention to these developments. And if you're a consumer, one of the things that this effort's supposed to do is it's supposed to kind of provide investors with some comfort that they're getting a certain level of advice. But if there's kind of a bifurcation and there's a shattering of the standards of care, we end up with many different standards. It's unclear kind of how that helps consumers. So it's an area that you're going to want to be paying attention to. If you're a consumer, you're going to want to be talking to your advisor, your broker. You're going to want to understand what standard of care you're getting. And if you're a broker or a distributor, an RIA, you'll really want to be paying attention as this develops because standards of care are changing.
Yeah, I got to think this is kind of an ebb and flow at this point. I mean, we know that's based on what you've reported in the last couple of weeks with the decision of the Fifth Circuit. Now we need to kind of, consumers really need to be more vigilant as we're kind of, just be aware. And I think that's important. Do you think that, George?
Well, I certainly do. And I always think that consumers need to be taken into consideration any advice that they're getting and sort of playing devil's advocate. So yes, totally agree. So
yeah, I think it actually ties into what we talked about last week. And, I know, Kevin, you weren't on for that particular segment, but we had Dan Alexander on from Principal Review, and he was talking about the different forms of compensation that advisors and brokers can get, direct and indirect, and how people need to be vigilant. But I think people also need to be vigilant to your earlier point about what type of services are they getting? Are they getting the what type of standard of care are they getting? What types of fees are they paying? So, I think you're right. This is going to cause some muddying of the waters a little bit, at least initially, as these things kind of work themselves out. And then if I am correct, I think I heard that the SEC is also coming up with some fiduciary standard as well. Am I incorrect on that?
So the SEC has said that they're working on a new standard of care and that they're hoping to have something out by the end of the second quarter. And there's kind of a point here that we're talking about the consumer side of this, and that there's something else to keep in mind, which is that the higher standard of care, it's likely going to increase compliance costs. So, I think everybody wants the highest standard of care at the lowest cost.
Right.
And it's really a balancing act of what's right for each individual or what's right kind of for this time in the market.
It's what kind of popped into my head first when you mentioned how the CFP Board of Standard announced this. Do you think that they already had an intention of announcing that they were bringing forth their own, or had the fiduciary rule gone through, would they simply have said, we're on board with the language of this rule?
So I'm not sure what the CFP board's intentions were.
Right.
The language tracks the fiduciary rule pretty well.
Okay.
And they were supporters of the fiduciary rule. So in a way, the point of this might've been just to add additional color, to provide additional clarity, to CFP certified professionals, letting them know how the board was interpreting DOL standards.
Got it. Just from a consumer standpoint, are there any red flags if all of a sudden there's 10 different entities that are saying this is the new standard, or how is that really going to affect the everyday investor, if at all?
Well, what worries me is that investors won't know what standard of care they're buying. Because, I do think there's a place for buying suitable advice. I do think there's a place for buying fiduciary advice. And it depends on the needs of the investor. But right now, we're moving to a world where best interest is going to have a variety of meanings, or could have a variety of meanings, because we've seen rules out of the New York Insurance Regulator, the National Insurance, the NAIC, and then a handful of states where they all say best interest, but they all have their own slightly different words for what that best interest standard is. And I think that could be a more dangerous place where there's this phrase and it's unclear what it means.
Got it. Excellent stuff.
Yeah, that's clearly Yeah, excellent stuff, Kevin. I don't know how you keep up with it. I mean, you must be around the clock. I mean, between reconciling the fiduciary rule and keeping up with what these states are doing, I mean, do you ever sleep?
So it's a lot of reading, and right now is a really active time. I mean, at Groom, we're focused on really best interest and above standards of care. So right now, with the action going on in the marketplace, we've got a ton of resources being spent on staying up to date on this stuff.
Nice.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, I mean, you know, keep at it. You're the guy on the hill, and you know, I know Congress is on a break, so maybe that gives you a little bit of a reprieve. You know, I guess the last question is, now that the fiduciary, you know, kind of changing topics a little bit, but not really, the fiduciary standard, you know, kind of defeated at least by the Fifth Circuit, and RESA not being included in the bill. Does that allow Congress, do you think, this year, to focus on some other things, or is that just, you know, it's an election year and we're just focused on winning the House and winning the Senate? You know, what's your gut tell you?
I think there might be some opportunities for low-hanging fruit. I think the bigger focus is going to be on the select committee that's working on the multi-employer system, because they've been really tasked with proposing something by November. Mm-hmm. So that's where the focus is going to be. If some other retirement pieces get added on to get that over the hurdle, I could see more retirement legislation moving that way. At the same time, there aren't a lot of vehicles remaining that have to move. I know there's still efforts being made to get legislation moving. There is bipartisan legislation out there in the retirement space. It's just difficult as we move closer and closer to the election to see it getting floor time.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that we get some good information about the pension bill and we get something solved there, because we certainly need some help on that front, definitely. Kevin Walsh from Groom Law, thank you so much for joining us. We wish you a very great weekend. Have a good holiday. And we'll look forward to having you back next week with more exciting news as it relates to retirement and financial services.
Thanks, guys.
Welcome back. Sure. Joining us are the two fantastic overseers, purveyors of all things stock market, Oliver Rennick and Kevin Kelly. Oliver from TD Ameritrade and Kevin from Bloomberg. Jeff, do you notice how I got Kevin's last name correct?
Yeah, I knew someone was going to rub that in. Kevin, let me just apologize to you.
Much appreciated, George.
Nice. I can tell where this is all going. So George, tell us about your weekend.
My weekend.
No, just kidding.
Oh, okay.
Deflection. That was just deflection.
So, you know what, smart guys, tell us all about the markets. Who wants to go first?
I think I went first last time. I'll let Kevin jump in.
I'll bat lead off here with the opening day yesterday. The interesting note, we wrapped up the first quarter this week. Stock market with its worst quarterly performance in September of 2015. Some people are kind of harping on that, but you have to remember where we're coming from. You know, we've had 9 straight consecutive quarters of gains before that. So not something you're too worried about. What people are really starting to, I think, take notice of, you had a little bit more geopolitical tension kind of coming to the market this week. But the big story, and I'm sure Ollie will expand a bit on this as well, is big tech. I think big tech's really at this inflection point right now. I think Facebook's kind of just the tip of the iceberg here. Some of the potential, you know, legal or regulatory ramifications that can come to the market for some of these big tech names, Google comes to mind, but even companies like Amazon, the way in which, you know, big data is being used and stored, I think, is going to be a topic that's not going to go away, at least, you know, in the near term. So what does that mean for the market? I mean, tech's a huge sector, making up almost a quarter of the S&P right now. So if you do see weakness in big tech, it wouldn't be surprising to see weakness in the overall stock market. But it could provide some opportunity for people that are looking to get into what we like to call value stocks, or kind of more undervalued stocks, because typically you pile into something like tech or growth when there's really not, or I should say less than average growth within the domestic economy. And right now, I mean, all projections are that we might see an acceleration in GDP, profit growth for stocks is supposed to be up next year. So it could be a time for, you know, value investors who have really not done too well compared to growth investors over the last, you know, really 18 months. We could see an inflection point there where value starts to become the the hot trade again, though. But I think big tech is definitely what we're watching.
Nice. Mr. Rennick, thoughts?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, focus very much on tech companies, not only in the social media space, but also the actual chip makers, which I think kind of went a little bit overlooked this week, also down. So it's pretty much across the board. I think what you're seeing is a pretty phenomenal sort of thing happening in markets from a very, in the most literal sense, phenomenal in terms of somebody wants to try to kind of assess how markets work and how risk works. A lot of times us in the media refer to days or weeks as is risk on or risk off, and it gets kind of old and it's overused for sure. But it also, for times like this, does a really good job of showing why we call it that. And if you think about basically what's happened throughout not just the bull market, but especially the last year in 2017, so much excitement about speculative behavior. I mean, things that beyond just the stock market, of course, whether it's crypto assets, whether it is different types of investing, whether it's flows into ETFs that we saw in January of 2018. So many signs that we finally reached that enthusiasm that was really a constructive part of the bull market because it wasn't there. And that enabled, I think, a very low volatility environment. But suddenly, when you have a big swath of money come into this market from individual investors, levered institutions, then when things get rocky, they get really rocky. So number one, I think the volatile market that many called for is very much here. And you're just starting to see, I think, these kind of dominoes start to fall in terms of where people are comfortable taking risk. If you think about a spectrum of a sort of fundamental underpinning for why you're in something, on the very riskiest part of that spectrum would be cryptocurrencies and crypto assets and the blockchain pivoted companies that came, and all that is falling apart. The companies that tried to pivot to the blockchain stuff, they're done. Their bubbles have popped. They're back to levels they were before they made these announcements. You see the crypto assets start to fall. And then the question is, all right, well, if that's happening there, where else might people be a little uncomfortable with their risk? And you look at a company like Tesla, and when you're losing money and you have basically a race against the clock to get your product out, it's very analogous. And I think we start to see that weakness then creeping in everywhere. So the big question, to bring it back to Kevin's point, is whether or not people will feel comfortable with the risk they're taking in technology companies and social media companies. Some have different fundamental cases than others, and we'll find out how real comfortable investors are with those. And that's going to decide, I think, whether or not you see a prolonged weakness in this market.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I was going to ask a question. Do you think we get back to fundamentals? I mean, I remember, I'm old enough to remember the bull run in the 90s and how we kind of got off track in terms of fundamentals. And we've had a real period of real growth, not just in the last couple months, but over the last year or several years, I guess. And do we ever get back to the fundamentals where people are actually looking at balance sheets, a lot of our audience are investors in mutual funds, where they may be participants in a 401k plan, which invests in mutual funds, or are participants in a pension plan, or just have an IRA. But they're relying on managers to do fundamental and technical analysis to make sure that, that an investment is appropriate. So I wonder if we get back there fully as a result of some of this volatility.
I think it's a really important question. I think that in many times we've been tempted to say yes when the market corrected the way it has, and it turned out to be a just return to the growth companies, and the value continued to underperform. That's happened in every correction we've had basically throughout the bull market. But there's a lot of reasons to think that this time actually will be different because of that interest rate backdrop. And I want to get Kevin's take on that too. But I think a real risk to that not being the case is if you continue to see strength in bonds, you continue to see a momentum turnaround in terms of bond yield not breaking higher. If the Fed has to be dovish, then Jeff, I think it would probably be an environment that we were more used to. But, there's just so many different headwinds. It's hard to really, you've got to be careful before you say now this, this time is different, because you would have been wrong in the past, of course.
Yeah. And I, Just chime in there. I agree with Oliver. I think a lot of it's based on central bank liquidity, right? Like Oliver was referring to, if you see the Fed kind of scale back and have to become more dovish, I think you could potentially see a return to what we're used to, you know, at least the last few years, which is some of these tech or growthy names outperforming. Two quick points, you know, to what Jeff brought up. I do think you can get back to what we would consider a stock picker's market, right? For a lot of the last, you know, 5 but really 8 years is this bull run. You've seen this big move into passive. Oliver referenced this earlier when he's talking about ETF flows, a big move into passive investments. But I think active is very cyclical, right? So in downturns, you know, in upswings, you would expect active not necessarily to outperform because, you know, a lot of times they're hedging their risk, right? So if they're not fully indexed to the S&P 500, which is one of the best stock markets in the world over the last, you know, 7 or 8 years, then by nature they would underperform. But when it comes to, you know, prior levels of elevated not only prices but valuations similar to, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s, I think a big kind of stark, you know, contrast of that time is that these tech companies, although they do have a lot of pricing power and they do, some of these sectors are a little more concentrated, they are generating, you know, significant amount of revenue and it, more importantly, significant profits, right? You're not seeing this kind of pets.com IPO surge era. You're seeing a lot of these tech companies grow because their fundamentals are getting stronger. They have stronger balance sheets. They're not as levered up as you know, some of these companies were that basically slapped .com next to their name in the late 90s, early 2000s. So I do think you can get back to fundamental stock picking, but a lot of that is going to be a little external in terms of, you know, what the Fed does as well.
I think we should launch George.com. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Oliver.
No, I'm just going to say, I think Kevin brings up a good point, which is we have to be careful not to equate a removal of risk from the market or a downturn in terms of the market overall with one that has to be negative for social media or technology, because, you know, a company like Facebook makes money. Okay. You know, that is going to be changing perhaps as they revisit all their data. So maybe it's not the best example, but that's kind of it's sort of within the same vein of what I was talking about with that kind of spectrum of risk, right? I think that if people are going to assume a lower market means a big downturn in the technology groups that have been there, it's a case-by-case basis. So a lot of those companies have done very well, yes, because they're the biggest part of, you know, an ETF that tracks the S&P 500, but also because they're actually disrupting and have very disruptive technologies. But again, that's where it's going to be important for investors and money managers to say, all right, can I rely on just the core case for what this company does and how they make money in their market, as opposed to a general appreciation of valuation? That's going to be more challenging.
So you mentioned that, you know, we're wrapping up the quarter. The market's been up and down. It's actually closed today, on Good Friday. What are you looking at for next week? And we've got about a minute left in the segment. What are you both looking at in terms of the week next week? What's top of mind, Oliver, as you you plan your show for the week, or your shows, excuse me, for the week?
Yeah, we got a big number of Friday everybody's waiting for on the economic data front. For me, it's not just that wages figure on Friday. It's also going to be looking at what are the catalysts. Is the market going to react to data that's strong? I think we had pretty solid data here this week, but yeah, you continue to see buying of treasuries. I'm most interested in that. I think stock market volatility is going to be there. And you got to watch that the 200-day moving average, man. It's magic. It's pretty wild the way it's been so resilient.
Yeah, I would say I echo all of Oliver's points. I'll put a little more emphasis from a short-term technical perspective on that 200-day moving average. You see a break below that. I mean, we talked about this quickly last week with the double bottom that stocks made back in, you know, August of 2015, and that sell-off. If you see them break below that 200-day moving average, I think we could definitely see some further weakness next week in the stock market.
Excellent stuff. And as we head into the weekend, Jeff, we've got Passover and Easter. So
I'm excited.
That's very exciting. I don't know.
I'm gonna be hiding the Afikoman.
Okay.
And hopefully Jody will be able to find it, or one of the cats.
Yeah,
That's a Passover joke.
Some red wine consumed on Saturday night for the Seder, and then my son is going to get a bunch of Easter candy, which my wife will promptly eat. So that's how that's going to go.
Nice. Well, guys, thanks so much, and appreciate it. You guys have a great weekend and a great week, and we'll talk to you next Friday.
Thank you, gentlemen. Have a good one.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, that was a great segment. We survived yet another market segment with Kevin and Oliver, George. That was wonderful, right?
Again, smart guys. They know their stuff.
Smart guys. I think they overdid us.
And I'm not just saying that because Kevin is still on the is still on the call.
I was wondering what that would sound like if I wasn't here.
Yeah, just like that. A lot of things we can't say off the air. But guys, we've got a great guest, someone that I greatly respect, a peer, James Venaruso from Callan. He's a senior vice president, investment consultant, plan consultant. He's very well known on the conference circuit. And webinar circuit. And Jimmy, we're great. It's great to have you on the show today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
I think, you know, really the purpose of what we want to get into is, you know, you're out there talking to clients, you're out there talking to folks in the industry, and just want to get your perspective on maybe some of the trends that you're seeing in the marketplace, whether it's defined contribution or other trends. If you wouldn't mind just kind of top of mind what you're seeing in the marketplace.
Sure. So I think during the last meeting cycle, the two things that have really jumped out to me in terms of trends, you know, the first one would be the refocusing on ESG. And for a while in defined contribution world, much talk of this. And unfortunately, due to recent events, it's kind of popped up into prominence again. So that has been interesting. And I'm curious to see if this is something that's going to be another blip and it'll fade, or if this is something that's going to have legs. So I think that's kind of the first one. You know, definitely have seen more talk about that. And then, you know,
my apologies. What's ESG?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm getting into like jargon and acronyms. So that would be environmental, social, and governance. So kind of funds that take those three things into consideration.
Thank you.
And really, you know, where the focus has been, and like I said, it's due to recent events, was on gun manufacturers. And it was interesting. I was at one client meeting, and they actually had an email from a participant that was basically demanding an investment option within the lineup that had nothing to do with civilian gun manufacturing. And that was definitely the first time I've seen something that specific.
Yeah, I'm certainly not surprised by it. How realistic is that?
Well, I guess it depends how far down the value chain you want to get. I think if you're going to screen out, I think there's five or so publicly traded civilian gun manufacturers, fairly straightforward. I think where it gets murky then is, you know, how far down the value chain do you go? Mm-hmm. What about people who make ammunition? What about if it's for government and police use, not civilian? And what about the financing of those operations? So I think that initially, it seems pretty clear, but then, you know, as I said, once you get down that road, it depends how much of the onion you want to peel.
And this isn't, I mean, that's not the only issue, right? I mean, there's issues around fossil fuels, divestment from certain parts of the world. I mean, this is from time to time when issues arise, societal issues arise, this is kind of sparks that debate that I think you're alluding to.
Exactly. And it's always seems like there's a catalyst. So a couple of years ago, maybe more, it was Sudan. Sudan was in the newspapers, what was going on in Darfur. So there was a big push for divestment there. And now recently it's about guns. So it'll be interesting, as I said, to see if this is something that's lasting. Is this going to be something permanent, or is this something that will fade away and people will forget about it?
Got it. And I know that you can't speak for large funds, but how seriously do they take it? Obviously, they're wanting to listen, but do they give it a quarter or two quarters to see if these demands still persist before they start making decisions?
It's probably in terms of the number of people.
Okay.
So if there's one squeaky wheel, generally, and this is in so a defined contribution plan, not a pension. They can usually say, well, we have a brokerage window, go with God, no pun intended, and, you know, find whatever ethical investment you would like. But I think once it reaches the point where there's multiple people constantly pinging HR, the investment committee, for this, then it's something that they consider. So I think that that's, again, it's not to say that it's, well, a month goes by, no one says anything. I think that it has to be a sustained effort on the part of participants.
Yeah, I would also add, and probably this, you know, the investment policy statement, many individual investors may not be aware that most plans have an investment policy statement that dictates the type of investments and the policies that people follow. So I would imagine that, Jimmy, that you know, that's part of the conversation you have as well with clients is, okay, well, do we want to include ESG funds? What's our tolerance level? All those kind of, you know, what are our metrics to measure some of these issues? Because you also don't want to go willy-nilly, mm-hmm. I would imagine, and just say, okay, well, today we're not going to invest in guns, but then we'll still invest in fossil fuels. And then, you know, 3 months later, there's an oil spill. Unfortunately, the environment is ruined in a certain area. And you know, so the investment policy really is designed to frame that out, right?
Exactly. And I think what you were kind of pointing to is that's why it's so tricky for a lot of committees and a lot of plan sponsors is how can you appease everyone's moral compass? And I think that's the challenge a lot of plan sponsors have when they're looking at these options. So it's one thing to say, great, we have latitude in the IPS, the investment policy statement, let's add a socially responsible option. Okay, now what does that mean? So it can mean so many things to so many different people that at least what I've seen is, you know, we had that acronym ESG. I think there's a lot of agreement on G. So we know what constitutes good governance. We don't want a firm run by crooks. All right, we can agree on that. It's the E and the S, so the environmental side and the social side where you start getting into, I think, a very gray area. So I think that's the thing we're currently grappling with now, both on the consultant side and on the manager side is, you know, G, we get it. We can agree there. But once you start getting into E and S, it gets a little slippery.
Yeah, certainly a lot more nuance in the E and the S. Well, I'm curious, and I think Kevin can probably help us with this, with all the volatility that's been going on, how that's been affecting multi-asset class providers. I'm sure it's not been easy.
What's interesting is last year we did one target date fund search for the whole year, and this year we currently have four going on, and that's all just, I think, largely a product of volatility. So I think that for the past now 10 years, with 08 rolling off 10-year performance, there was a lot of complacency. And I think that, you know, when you looked back at the performance record, everything looked great. But it's not until you really had this bump in the road that people realize, wow, there's a lot of risk buried there. So whether it's risk for people 50 years and older, I think that's one that definitely stands out is, you know, how much equity is the right amount? Mm-hmm. And granted, when things are going great, more is better. But now that things for the quarter were flat, a little down, I think that's brought in a renewed awareness to this. And I think also that the fixed income side is also one that's caused a lot of people in multi-asset to start paying attention again. With diversification there, it's not easy. So if you're in an ag strategy, you know, your duration's right around six. Is that where you want to be? Or do you want to go outside the spectrum in credit? All right, well, it's pretty late in the cycle. Again, you can argue that may not be the best time to do it. So I think that the short answer, or long answer rather, is there's really no safe place in fixed income. And that's kind of where we're seeing the wheat separated from the chaff right now.
Yeah. And if I could just piggyback off that real quick, I totally agree. And I think you've seen the rise in popularity of some of these, you know, risk optimizing or risk parity funds. And a lot of those oftentimes have a volatility gauge kind of built into them, right? So as you see more volatility in a certain asset class, they may actually reduce exposure to it, which you could make the argument, you know, hurt stocks maybe in the shorter term if some of these bigger funds that have accumulated a lot of assets in recent years start to move away from equities, which have historically been, you know, in this lower volatility regime the last couple of years, as volatility picks up. So kind of almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a weird sense.
And I think the other area, it's really the volatility is highlighted. And man, was it a great marketing gimmick? Well, I shouldn't say gimmick, but a great marketing stroke to call, you know, in smart beta, low vol. I love them, the names attached to the factors. Well, this is a low vol factor, and, you know, or a quality factor. Who wouldn't want that, especially after the quarter we just had?
Right. And then between quality, I mean, you could ask 10 different people on the street and they'd all define quality differently.
Yeah. I think that's why, you know, in your role, Jimmy, I mean, your job is really to translate. You work with very astute people as trustees or as part of boards, and they're very smart. But your job is really to translate and to kind of cut through the clutter of the day. And you and your team at Callen have a deep research area, right, that kind of cuts through that noise to make sure that people understand exactly what they're getting. And then also that information can be passed on to participants if it's outside a multi-asset strategy.
Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of, I think, what we're tasked to do. It's not to go in with a black box and say, okay, well, here's a recommendation. We think you should do it. I think it's more an education role in saying, okay, here's something. Here's what's good about it. Here's what we don't like about it. Here are the pros. Here are the cons. Which direction do you want to go in? And, you know, to your point, DC is just so unique as a space because you're not only dealing with boards, which have their own intricacies and different levels of sophistication, but at the end of the day, it's all filtering down to the participant. And that's just a whole separate group that's all over the place in terms of their needs and their level of sophistication and understanding.
Jimmy, I got a quick question for you on that point. How much of fees do you take into consideration when you're going through this kind of educational process? You have this big move. There's kind of a two-part question, I guess you could say. You have this big move towards lower fees, obviously, as people become, you could say, a little more aware of how high some of these management fees are. So the first part is, how much, you know, do fees matter? And then the second part being, you know, I'm kind of shocked, and this might be a compliance issue or a regulatory issue, so I'm curious to hear your two cents on it, of why more plans don't offer lower cost investment vehicles such as ETFs in their plans, where you could get exposure to a similar, let's say, asset allocation for, you know, maybe half the price.
So I guess there's a couple of different reasons why that is. You know, the ETF one, very few record keepers for 401k plans can administrate ETFs. And the problem there is with the valuation process. So they're used to, and their systems are on end of day valuation for mutual funds and collective trusts. So it's not as if they can't do it. We put a man on the moon. I think if they want to deal with ETFs, they could. I think it's more just a resource allocation factor of building that out. And then I guess to the second point. Fees are obviously crucial right now, and it's something both we and our clients spend a lot of time on. And I think it's unfortunate in a sense because I think the conversation's really gotten away from net of fee performance. I think people tend to look at fees in a vacuum and say, well, this one's cheaper than that one, therefore it's better. And that's not always the case. So I think that our job is, you know, kind of as a first filter, is this fee reasonable? You know, is it in range of what we're seeing? And then it's, okay, is the fee justified? And, you know, the other thing I would point out that I think is, to me, frustrating in this industry is that that's all fine and good for really large plan sponsors who can use their scale and basically to leverage managers and get low fees. But the ones who are really hurting are the smaller plans. You know, they're the ones that don't have those options. It's kind of take it or leave it. And when you look at a lot of small plans pay, I mean, they're multiples higher than what you would see in a very large plan. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate that just because you work for a smaller employer, you're saddled with higher fees.
That's a really, really good point. And that is a tricky one to figure out.
Yeah, hopefully we get somewhere with multi-employer plans. And I know there's seemingly bipartisan support. And it's one of those things, you know, I'm not exactly as intimately aware of how the sausage is made in Washington, but hopefully they can get somewhere with that because it just seems to me like such an obvious win for whoever can get that done politically.
Yeah, we don't understand how the sausage is made either, which is why we rely on Kevin Walsh to tell us. But yeah, I was going to think that you were going to bring up multiple employer plans, because that certainly sounds like a win-win for a lot of the smaller employers. But I guess more to come on that. And it is an election year, so who knows what we actually get. And we've got, you know, there's priorities like pensions and other things that probably you know, you can't get it all in one stroke. But
I don't think we're going to have a million person march demanding multi-employer plans in Washington. It's not a sexy cause, but no, I think it's an important one.
But we're trying to do our part, though. We're trying to make bring sexy back to retirement, and I think you're part of that.
And, is that why I'm on?
Yeah, well, one of the reasons, and I know one of the reasons, and I think that keeping these conversations going and people listening, and you doing your part in terms of educating, you and your team's doing the part of educating plan sponsors, maybe not about bringing sexy back, is a way to kind of get people thinking about more than just fees, more than just the raw performance, and getting into some of these other more less quantitative things like education and communication and things like that. So let's keep it rolling, I guess.
Yeah.
So
thanks a lot, Jimmy.
All right, thanks guys.
Have a great weekend.
You too. Take care.
And that was Jimmy Venaruso, Senior Vice President at Callan. That was a great segment. We appreciate him coming on. Now joining us is Alessandra Melito from Dow Jones Market Watch. Welcome, Allie.
Hey, how are you?
We are doing great. It's Friday. Everybody's in a good mood.
Great. I'm glad to hear it.
So Jeff was just telling me, and that's not honest. He was not just telling me. I think you have cats, Jeff.
I have two cats. I have two cats, and one was just in my lap.
Okay. Well, it turns out that 36% of Americans are dog owners, and they prefer human beings more than – or I'm sorry, they prefer dogs more than people. I don't know if you knew that.
I didn't know that. Where did you come up with this stat?
My Google machine told me that.
Oh, okay. Well, kudos to Google. What else are they telling you?
Well, I wanted to find a clever transition into something I wanted to talk to Allie about, which are dog parks. So, yeah. Allie, tell me about dog parks.
So it appears to be that there are a lot of dog parks in the metro areas, and people are starting to look for ways to incorporate their favorite pets when they're making moves. So apparently, 774 dog parks are in the 100th biggest metro areas, and that's about a 5% increase over the last year and 40% since 2009. So it's actually one of the fastest growing amenities in some of the biggest U.S. cities. Who knew?
40% growth since 2009 of dog parks. Wow.
Yeah.
Maybe we should get into the... Oh, go ahead, Alan.
I was just going to say, who doesn't love watching dogs run around and play? Like, it's one of my favorite things, so understandable.
Were you just about to say that we should invest in dog parks, Jeff?
I was going to say that I feel like that's a really good business opportunity. I'd be happy to walk dogs. I love dogs. I mean, I like our cats. I never had cats before I met Jody, and now I have two. But I love dogs. Always wanted a Siberian Husky. I think that's a beautiful dog, and I love animals and dogs, and I would love to go to the dog park. So maybe I'll do that this weekend if it's nice here in New York.
Well, fair enough. And Allie, I know that the president is always in the news, but it seems like the president was taking aim at everybody's favorite company these days.
Yeah, so he was tweeting criticisms about Amazon this week, and Amazon stock actually fell sharply as a result of that. But it's okay because everybody still loves Amazon. I mean, what with Amazon Prime and 2-day shipping and all that stuff, and the fact that they sell everything, it's still the go-to retailer for a lot of Americans. And in 2017, it was actually ranked as the top brand in the U.S. according to YouGov Brand Index, which is an analytic firm, and they look at different brands throughout the day.
Got it.
Yeah, I use Amazon, and you know, I don't criticize people on Twitter, but I do use Amazon and shop online, and I think that's helpful. I also like to shop in the store too, but I think it's interesting, quite frankly, that people can tweet things negatively, and then it just precipitates a drop in the market for that or that stock. I think that's kind of interesting to me. So it's interesting. That's an interesting factoid, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's okay. No doubt about it. I think it's that frankly has always been sort of a concern of mine, and I'm not saying that any of this is fake news or real news. It's just his opinion on something, and we'll see. But what does happen when some fake piece of information is disseminated via social media and it causes a major market event? I think that will be very, very interesting, because it's bound to happen if it hasn't already. So, but I digress. Let's talk about a really fun and exciting topic, which is being audited by the IRS.
Oh, yeah. So fun.
Whee!
So the good news is you're not likely to get an audit, in the sense that the IRS, the number of audits has hit the 15-year low. There is less than 1% of people who are audited by the IRS. However, of course, that doesn't mean that you won't be, in that, you know, you can go running free with your tax returns. You still have to follow the rules.
Right.
But at least it's nice to know that not as many people are getting audited.
That, yeah. And
the important thing to note, though, is that if you are getting audited, you're going to be receiving a letter through the mail. I think I might have talked about this last week, but a lot of people are falling victim to scams, and that's because they get these phone calls or these emails from people saying that they're an IRS agent, and that's just not how the IRS notifies taxpayers of audits. They do so only by U.S. mail. And then it goes into, like, you know, talking to an agent on the phone. Like, you would be the one to follow up with the agent. So,
got it.
Yeah, that's disconcerting. That people. I mean, I think it's just horrible that people would try to do that. Especially to, you know, I remember hearing stories about the elderly, you know, who get either refunds or, you know, Social Security or Medicare payments, and those monies would be misappropriated or taken, or, you know, they would get lured into, you know, scams. And I think that's just, you know, just obviously horrible. And whatever we can do to cut down on that would be a great thing, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
For
actually,
sure.
So do you know what the age group is that falls victim to phone scams the most this tax season?
I would guess it would be older people.
But it's not. It's actually millennials. Millennials are more likely to fall for these scams over the phone. You know, people in their 20s and 30s were 6 times likelier than baby boomers to disclose personal information.
Wow.
From callers saying, you know, callers who can verify their last 4 digits, which has become, unfortunately, probably not as hard for some people because of all these data breaches that have been occurring in the past couple of years.
Well, see, that certainly makes sense now that I had a second to think about it, because when a 20-year-old's telephone rings, it must be so shocking that their social media device is buzzing and there's another human being on the other side of the line. So,
yeah, and not only another human being, but one that actually has their information. So it appears like somebody who, you know, you can trust, or that if they're saying that they're an IRS agent, or they're saying that they have your information, they just wanted to follow up, it seems more legitimate than like a robot talking to you, you know, when you pick up the phone.
I got it. And in a feel-good story for the week, if you could take us out with something to make everybody smile.
Okay, so I have one. Haddish, who is an actress from the movie Girls Trip. A story has been circulating after she had an interview with GQ, and she said what she does when she got rich, the first thing that she did was take care of her family. So her mom was in a mental institution. She had some issues, and her grandmother is also sick. She has Alzheimer's. So what she's been doing is paying for nurses to care for them, and she moved them into a place close to her sister, and she has delivery service that sends them fresh food 3 times a day. So it was actually, I think, a very happy story, because usually when you think of celebrities who are making a ton of money, you think of, like, huge houses and cars and crazy luxurious lives, but this woman in particular has been taking care of her family and with some serious issues, like serious health issues too.
Well, that's awesome. So it turns out maybe money can't buy happiness, but it can take care of a lot of people. So good stuff.
I thought so.
Well, Allie, thank you so much. You have fun plans for the weekend?
Just relaxing. Yeah.
That sounds nothing like crazy. Fun to me.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, and we will talk with you next week.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Allie. And that was Alessandra Melito, who was Dow Jones Market Watch personal finance reporter, showing us some very interesting insights and some good factoids, and leaving us on a feel-good moment, which is great. George, what a show, right?
Yeah. Yeah, again, I think mildly, at least our guests successfully tackled some difficult issues and gave us a bunch of really great information. And yeah, I think we even had a little bit of fun. So, success.
Yeah. And you survived Vegas. We'll have to talk offline about the story.
Yeah, and my brain, be it mild, be it somewhat soft, was still able to function enough. So,
yeah. Well, it was great. It was great. I'm looking forward to next week. We've got some more great guests. We're going to have our contributors back, and we're going to be joined by some other – maybe we're going to be joined by some plan sponsors, some employers talking about their plans. So we're going to keep trying to mix it up on the show, bring some very interesting people with some interesting backgrounds. And, you know, I would just say to the audience, I think you would echo this, is you have feedback for us, please feel free to share it. You can do it through LinkedIn. You can do it through email. You can do it through Twitter. We want suggestions to how to make the show better.
Yes, definitely want feedback, and appreciate everybody listening.
So, George, have a great weekend. Enjoy the Easter egg hunt and the Passover Seder.
Yes, sir.
I'll have fun with the cats doing Passover, and Jody, of course. And we'll talk to each other next week.
Thank you, man.
All right, take care, bud.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.